Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Well, recently, I had the distinct pleasure of attending for the first time in my life the Parliament of World Religions. A little history. In 1893, the first Parliament of World Religions took place in Chicago at the World's Fair. And it was such a success, they decided to do it again in 1993. Yeah, it took them 100 years, probably, you know, committee problems, too many committees, too many regulations. Regardless, the Parliament of World Religions started becoming a semi-regular thing, convening every 4 years, for the most part, in different cities around the world. This last one in early November convened in Toronto, and I enjoyed myself very much. I met several people, and as you can probably guess, at a place like that, one of the things I was thinking of, who could I have on Common Threads? Well, I found one particular woman who was quite fascinating. You have to understand that part of the Parliament is plenary sessions and breakout sessions, etc. But another part of it is, if you've ever been to a trade show where you go to some convention hall and you have a very large room and it's filled with booths of different vendors, that's kind of how the bottom floor of the Toronto Convention Center was for the Parliament. So you walk around, and this is a very large room, and you have just about every kind of religion and spiritual movement that you can think of, and they all have booths, and you can engage with people, you can take free literature, you can do a variety of things down there. Well, I was walking around the hall, and I come across a booth that was filled with women who are Catholic priests. Now, naturally, that cocked my eyebrow a bit, I must say. So I engaged with these women, and this is what they claim to be: Roman Catholic priests, fully ordained, and yet all women. So one woman that I spoke to in particular was Mary Eileen Collingwood, and she has agreed to come on our show and tell us just exactly how a woman can become a Roman Catholic priest. A little bit about Mary Eileen. She's a wife, mother, grandmother, and educator who earned her MA in theology from St. Mary Seminary and Graduate School of Theology in Ohio. She's taught theology on the secondary and college levels, served as a pastoral minister in parishes, and as director of a diocesan office. She currently is a faculty member for Global Ministries University and the People's Catholic Seminary. Mary Eileen was ordained a priest in 2014 and ordained a bishop in apostolic succession in 2015. She serves as bishop for the Association of Roman Catholic Women Priests and is a member of the presiding team at the Community of St. Bridget, an inclusive Catholic community in Brecksville, Ohio. So we welcome to Common Threads, Mary Eileen Collingwood. Hello, Mary Eileen.
Hello, thank you. Thank you, Fred. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. I can only imagine you answer this question, you're posed this question many, many times from people of a variety of religious backgrounds. How can a woman be a Catholic priest when all we hear from the Vatican, all we have ever heard from the Vatican is, no, you can't? They're open to the possibility of married priests, and certainly there are married male priests, so that's not impossible. But I've heard it said from theologians or clergy that it is as much impossible for a woman to become a Catholic priest as it is for a man to have a baby. So tell us just exactly how you became a priest and how you validate that.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the question. The way a woman can become a priest is to do some research, find the association that I belong to, or the Roman Catholic Women Priests movement that is international, and do a little history, study of history, and discover that in 2002, there were seven women in Germany that were ordained Catholic priests by bishops in good standing with the Roman Catholic Women, Roman Catholic Vatican authority. Okay, so these particular bishops came to this boat that was floating down the Danube River, and these women were on it, and they were ordained by these men in good standing with Rome, and so their particular ordinations were valid because a bishop in good standing ordained them. However, they are illicit due to the fact that it goes against the church's canon law. Okay, so we broke an unjust law, but yet we were validly ordained by a bishop in good standing with Rome. So we carry that with us. We know that the church, the official Catholic Church, Roman Catholic Church, does not consider our ordinations licit according to their man-made laws. This is not a God law here. It's a man-made law that can be changed. And so we broke that unjust law, and we became priests, validly ordained by these bishops in good standing, because it's the bishop that confers ordination. And if they are in good standing, then they confer it. And this is what happened to these seven women. So since then, the following year, in 2003, one of the bishops contacted two of the women that were ordained and invited them to be ordained a bishop, so that he no longer had to go around in secrecy ordaining, that it could just take off and the women could go on and develop their presence within the church. And so in 2003, two of the women were ordained bishops. And that is the beginning of the story. So from those seven on the Danube River in 2002 till today in 2018, we have over 270 ordained women in this movement to reform the Roman Catholic Church.
There's a lot there that I want to get to. First of all, now I have had this explained to me before, but not in a way that didn't make my head hurt. Tell us the difference, and please talk to me like I'm four. Tell us the difference between illicit and invalid.
The validity comes through the power, the legality, the licitness comes through a law. All right, so you have the power to do it, and then you have, are you following the law? So the person who had the power to confer ordination did it. The person that was ordained illicitly in that they did not follow the church law. So the power is granted. It cannot be ungranted, but we don't abide by the law. Now, let's just look at it this way. There are laws in people's countries that their conscience believes they cannot follow because it's not a just law. So too, we as women priests did not follow the canon law of the church, the man-made law. Women had no voice in making those laws at all. We believe they are totally unjust, and so we broke away from the institutional church by being ordained because we did not follow that law.
Okay, that my head feels just fine, and I think I get it.
Okay, good.
there, the way you told the story, there must be some significance of this ordination, the original ordination, happening on a boat in the Danube River. Am I correct?
Yes. The reason it was held on a boat is because that is international water. So no one had jurisdiction over there in Germany over what was going on that boat. So there was no, because, you know, over in Europe, they have tax codes that allow clergy to receive tax money from the governments. We don't have that here in the United States, but they do have that system in Europe. And so they did not want to be ordained in an area where some public official could come in and stop the ordination. So that is the reason why Christine Meyer Lumitzberger, the woman that spearheaded this movement, mortgaged her house so that she could pay for the rental of that boat. And that's where the bishops came, that's where the seven women as ordinands came, and that's where they were ordained.
And how were you able to find, or rather, these original women, mm-hmm. how were they able mm-hmm. to find a bishop who would do this? Or didn't you use the word bishops, plural?
Yes, I did. There were two of them that came for that ordination. Here's how it happened. A former Benedictine sister from Austria named Christine Meyer Lumitzberger had this vision and this desire and this this vision that women should be ordained in the Roman Catholic Church. She, in her ministries and what she had been involved in, gathered and talked with women about whether or not they would be interested in pursuing that. So she had upwards of, you know, over a dozen people. She put together, through her understanding, her studies, her expertise, she put together kind of like a seminary education for them. They went to different places, and they put this seminary experience together so they could prepare to be priests through study and prayer. And that went on, say, from the mid-1990s on. And people were asking her, well, what are you going to do once you're prepared? There's nobody to ordain you. And she said, if the Spirit is leading me through this preparation with these women, I am confident that at the time that we are ready, there will be a bishop ready to ordain us. So the word spread, okay? And sure enough, in 2002, didn't three bishops make their way to her in communication and said that they would be very happy to ordain and that she should, you know, figure it all out how to do it and that they would be there. Unfortunately, one bishop did not get there, but two of them did. And so they ordained the seven women that showed up on the Danube River on that boat. And that's how we got bishops that were willing to ordain, and that's how they got ordained.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Mary Eileen Collingwood, a wife, mother, grandmother, educator, and Roman Catholic priest. Mary Eileen, were there any consequences for those bishops who were involved in the ordination?
Actually, no, because they were not curtailed in any way. The women who were ordained received excommunication papers from the Vatican, excommunicating them for not following church law. So they are kind of persona non grata to the Catholic Church in that respect. But keep in mind, the power of ordination was conferred, so they do not accept the excommunication, nor do I accept any excommunication that the Vatican would impose on us, because we feel that we are following our consciences in not following an unjust law.
And that's fascinating that the bishops, are they still in good standing? Are they still, is this still their day job?
As far as I know, yes. In fact, we don't mention the names because the bishop that ordained our two bishops could have gotten in a lot of trouble for doing that. And we honor his privacy until after his death. And that's when that can be revealed, but not now.
When you say that these original women were educated to become priests, I'm just curious, do you know, can a woman receive the same education as a priest? Let's say someone who does not wish to become a priest, but someone who simply wishes to learn. Are there any courses in seminary that would be considered off-limits for women?
Well, to best answer that, I have to give my personal story about that. I went through the diocesan seminary here in Cleveland, Ohio, and received my master's in the diocesan seminary. I studied right along every seminarian in the Graduate School of Theology, okay? After I received my degree, a new bishop came in and did not like the fact that Catholic women were studying alongside priests, those, you know, seminarians to become priests, and he put limits on what courses, from then on, what courses women could be in the classroom with the priests. He put a limit on any Catholic woman could not receive the Masters of Divinity, but that a Lutheran woman or an Episcopalian woman, they would allow that, but not a Roman Catholic woman could not get that degree. And the reason for that is that he believed that women were coming into the seminary to prepare for Catholic priesthood, and he did not want to be a part of that.
That's fascinating.
So, yes.
So when you were taking those courses, did you feel you had the calling to be a priest at that time?
No, I did not pursue that education for priesthood at the time. I pursued it for ministry, professional ministry within the Catholic diocese here. I became a director of a diocesan office after that. I taught in schools and universities. I worked in parish work, and I believe that in order for me to be a credible minister, I had to receive that degree. So that's why I pursued that degree.
Did you get it? Did you have, you now have an MDiv?
No, I received a Master's of Theology because the MDiv, the program for the MDiv involved a lot of pastoral studies in ministry. I had already received that under a different venue. The Diocese of Cleveland at the time were preparing lay men and women for parish ministry, and you had to have a certification for that parish ministry. So with the classes that I took on a graduate level to obtain that certification actually put me over the number of courses that I had that would have been required for an MDiv. So I was looking at it very practically. You know, I have a large family. I didn't need to tack on more continuing ed bills for myself. So because I got that certification in pastoral ministry and it actually was much more extensive than any pastoral ministry studies that would have been given under the MDiv. I was satisfied with that certification, and I believed the master's in theology would put me where I needed to be. And that's why I pursued it in that vein. There was other women who went with the MDiv, and that's fine too. I didn't believe that I needed the MDiv. I would be replicating many of my courses by going for that degree.
You just mentioned something in answering the question about having a large family.
Yes.
Your bio indicates you are a wife, mother, and grandmother. And so, obviously, to be a Catholic priest in your community, celibacy is not a requirement. Is that correct?
To be a woman priest in this movement, absolutely not. I don't believe that anybody should be curtailed from having a family and being in ministry and being a priest in ministry. So that is one part of the reform of the Catholic Church that needs to take place, absolutely. You know, we go out, we step out as prophetic witnesses to a life that the Church is called to lead, and we are part of that movement to get it there. It may not happen in my lifetime. It may happen in my children or grandchildren's lifetime. That would be wonderful. But if we don't do this now, it will take much longer. This is a big, huge institution. It's the biggest segment of Christianity that has not opened its doors to women in ordained ministry. So we feel that this is very important, that we have to live the inclusive call to priesthood now so that we can witness to what the vision is for ordained priesthood.
Tell us a little bit about what it is like to be a priest and maintain your family life. So, for instance, how many hours a week do you dedicate to actual pastoral work? And how much do you dedicate to your family? Are you still in the process of raising children, or are they all adults now?
All my children are adults. They range in age from 24 to 39. I have 7 children. I have 4 grandchildren. For my work that I do now in ministry, I spend at least 8 hours a day in pastoral or ministerial work. It's like a full-time job, okay? Now, I will say that I am in a unique position because I don't have to work. There are other people in this movement, other women and men in this movement, that still have to maintain a day job or whatever it requires. And they do that, and they minister around that time and even within that time if the occasion is provided for them. So we are essentially working priests, okay? Like I said, I am in a unique position, and there are others like me, but not a whole lot, that don't have to depend on an income to survive, okay? So I do spend at least 8 hours a day in a ministerial research, writing, pastoral visits, preparations for liturgies, ecumenical meetings, all that, you know, some of the administration within our association I help out with. So it is a full-time job for me.
And finally, we're about down to the wire, but when I met you and your colleagues at the Parliament, I asked about any sort of honorific, any sort of title, and you seem to eschew that. You don't wish to be called Mother, Reverend, Bishop. Is that correct?
Well, for me personally, I believe that the word reverend comes from the word revered. And I don't believe that I'm any more revered than anybody else. I think God made us all equal, and we are called to, we are all called to some sort of priestly ministry. So I believe, as I stand in as one with others equally, and when we have liturgy together, I am the prayer leader as an ordained person. However, I share the prayers with everyone. If I'm wearing a stole when I come in, I take the stole off, put it on the altar, and say, I stand with you equally together. So I do not believe in a hierarchical status. I do believe that people are called to serve in particular capacities in different ways because the people of God need that type of leadership, and I'm glad to step in and do that. They elected me a bishop as bishop. I'm a bishop because it's necessary to be a bishop. We have to ordain, and so I have the power to confer ordination on people. That's the reason I'm a bishop. I'm not a bishop so that people can call me the most reverend or anything else. I don't believe that there should be a hierarchical status. Everybody's called to a particular role in living out their Catholic Christianity, and I believe that we have to respect each other that way. And so
okay.
I have the responsibility as prayer leader and conferring ordination.
I appreciate that. Mary Eileen, we're down to the wire, as I said, for this episode of Common Threads, but there's much more conversation to be had, so I'm hoping you'll join us next week and we can continue.
I'd be happy to. Thank you.
You're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today, Mary Eileen Collingwood, a Roman Catholic priest, part of the community of St. Bridget, and inclusive Catholic community in Brecksville, Ohio. Please join us again next week.